welcome to the Canine Conservationists podcast, where we're positively obsessed with conservation detection dogs. Join us every week to discuss detection training, canine welfare, conservation biology, and everything in between. I'm Kayla Fratt, one of the co-founders of Canine Conservationists, where we train dogs to detect data for land managers, researchers, agencies, and NGOs. We still don't have any new reviews on Apple Podcasts, so please stop making me feel like I'm repeatedly texting someone asking if they want to hang out and they're just not responding to me. Please stop ghosting me. Drop us a review. They really make my day. On a less sad note, though, today I have the joy of talking to Gabby Fleury, who is a PhD student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who is developing a carnivore livestock conflict mitigation project in collaboration with local NGO Cheetah Conservation Botswana and Botswana Predator Conservation. Gabby, whose pronouns are they, them, is a Fulbright scholar, a member of Forbes 30 Under 30 in Science, and a member of the Organizing Committee for Black Mammalogists Week. We're going to be talking about human-wildlife conflict, being Black in STEM, using local dogs to work on conservation issues rather than importing dogs, and so much more. I think you're really going to enjoy this podcast. I had a great time connecting with Gabby, and it was a real pleasure to get to talk to them and learn a bunch from them. But before we get into it, first, we're going to dive into our science highlight. So I was super excited a couple weeks ago to see this article pop up in my Google Scholar Alerts that is titled Comparing Narcotics Detection Canine Accuracy Across Breeds. It was published by Brian Lee Rice and Joseph Velasco in Cells Helion in summer 2023. And again, even though this is on narcotics dogs, I was stoked because I was really excited to see what this detection canine accuracy may vary looking across breeds. You know, I work with border collies. They're not considered a typical detection dog. People ask me all the time why we don't work with beagles. My next dog, I'm deeply considering getting a spaniel, maybe a lab if I have enough room for a dog that big, or it could just be another shelter mutt. So super excited about this. But before I even finished the abstract, I was pretty bummed out. It turns out that when the title says across breeds, what they meant was 25 Belgian Malinois and 9 German Shepherds, which you may recognize as 2 breeds that are very, very similar phenotypically, genetically. They're pretty closely related breeds. They're both shepherds that no longer are really used for herding and are much more kind of police and military bred. And, you know, the Malinois came from the German Shepherd, they're very, very closely related. And so we're not going to answer any questions about beagles versus spaniels or labs versus border collies with this paper, unfortunately. We're really just kind of looking at 2 very closely related breeds. It's just so hard to say much when you're trying to compare 2 breeds that are so similar and often crossbred. I would honestly be kind of interested if they had done, and as far as I could tell, they did not, done genetic tests on these dogs to see what proportion of the other breed may or may not be in there, because I know in a lot of police kennels that sort of crossbreeding is not uncommon. So the researchers basically had these drug dogs search rooms with 1 planted drug per room and compared the dog's number of correct alerts, false alerts, and misses. The handlers were searching blind, but were able to employ their own strategy. They didn't mention a timeline. They found that 11% of the German Shepherds made a false alert versus 4% of the Malinois. Although we do also have to remember that there was only 9 German Shepherds. So if there was 1 German Shepherd, that was kind of throwing the team off. We can't necessarily, the stats get a little messy there. The German Shepherds found 100% of the targets, while the Malinois found 98% of the targets. Given the sample sizes, those differences were not significant. The long story short here, I'm not really sure if there's anything in this paper that's useful as far as breed selection for detection work. I'm glad that they did the research, but it just didn't feel like anything that we could really apply. I suppose if they had found significant differences, that would have been really interesting and quite surprising. But I'm mostly quibbling with the title here. It's a pretty misleading title. But without further ado, let's go get to our interview with Gabby Fleury.
Hi all, Rachel here from Canine Conservationists. One of the ways you can support Canine Conservationists is by checking out our online store. At canineconservationist.org/shop, you can find hats, stickers, pet food mats, reusable grocery bags, mugs, and all sorts of shirts and jackets. I have one of the hoodies, and I think it's so comfortable and cozy. I also really love the Pride stickers. If you really don't need anything new, you can also make a tax-deductible donation to Canine Conservationists at canineconservationists.org/support-our-work.
All right, so welcome to the podcast, Gabby. I'm super excited to finally get to talk to you. We've been working on trying to make our schedules mesh for an embarrassingly long time. Why don't you start out with telling us a little bit about, take us back to you as a kid. How do you get into the world of ecology? Was this something you always wanted to do?
Yes. Yeah, just like a little brief introduction. So I'm a conservation biologist who works mostly on carnivore livestock mitigation. So I call myself an interspecies diplomat. I kind of work in the space between people and wildlife. And that kind of is a mix of all kinds of things, from behavioral science, both on the human side and on the animal side, to looking at wildlife ecology, to looking at One Health, to looking at, you know, psychology and political ecology and history and culture. So it's kind of like my field is like 12 fields had a baby. And then those fields were, you know, that field was then babysat by a bunch of other fields. So I kind of do all the things. But there is no primer on how to do that as a career, right? So it's always a really interesting question when people ask me, how did you get into conservation? Because I literally have no conscious memory when I wasn't wanting to be a conservationist. I just didn't know what that word was. So I was always interested in wildlife. Mm-hmm. So my dad is of Angolan descent. He's Brazilian Angolan. So I was always really interested in like Southern African conservation. My mom always jokes I saw The Lion King one too many times. I am a child of the 90s. But yeah, so I was always really interested in wildlife, really interested in wild places. And it's always interesting for me to think about, because when I was a little kid growing up watching documentaries, I never saw any people in those documentaries. And my entire job is working with people. And that's actually, you know, like I'm a people person. That's what I love to do. But it's really interesting because what I thought the job I would have when I was five is very different the job that I have now. So I was always really interested in protecting wildlife and very fascinated by animal facts. And I'm an osteosarcoma survivor, so a bone cancer survivor. So a lot of people say that they got into nature because they were out playing in puddles and in the forests and things like that. I was born in Boston, so I was born in a very urban environment. And I literally couldn't physically run until I was about 10. So I missed a lot of that getting my hands in the dirt. So what I did is I actually learned from books and from films, and I spent 3 years in the hospital reading animal textbooks and Ranger Rick comics and all these kind of things. So I fell in love with it kind of from that way, and then finally got to touch grass, so to speak, and become a conservationist after that. But that was actually one of the reasons why I was so passionate about getting better, is because I actually, and I'll be honest about this, mm-hmm. I wear a physical aid, so I have a brace in the field. A leg brace, because my left leg is mostly reconstructed below the knee. So as a physical mm-hmm. disability, when I was a kid, wanting to be a conservationist and knowing I needed to be fit and be able to be in the field actually was a huge motivator to go through 15 years of physical therapy to be able to do that.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And now I get to do that. So it doesn't impede me in the field at all. It's just a physical aid. But I'm really proud to say mm-hmm. that I don't know if I'd be walking again if I wasn't a conservationist. So that's a really kind of fun
story. Wow. I didn't know that. You know, I did an okay job of researching before this interview, but that's incredible. And I mean, I'm so glad that you had something that you were able to focus on and look forward to. Cause that my younger sister was very sick for a lot of our childhood. You know, having that driving force to learn how to walk again and to go through all of, you know, everything associated with that was so, so, so important for her. And, you know, she's now in medical school. That's the way that she ended up going. But yeah, that's an incredible. And I'm sorry you had to go through that as well. That sounds like a very tough childhood.
Yeah, but also it led to so many amazing things. I mean, So that was a really good part of that. And it also, having kind of those differences growing up made me kind of, I think, develop a lot of empathy towards differences. Mm-hmm. And just kind of trying to learn how to interact with a lot of different people who may be very different from me, whether that's a background or all these different differences between different people. And a lot of my work sometimes feels like being more like a UN ambassador than a conservationist. So I think a lot of having to learn how to navigate differences has been really important, because there's also trying to find those similarities, right? Bringing people into the one thing that they can all agree on. And I got really good at that through some of my challenges. So it's been good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really neat. So where did you, so you got to go outside, you got to start playing in the grass, you just got to start living out the Ranger Rick dreams. And then where did you directly go off to undergrad thinking you were like majoring in ecology or conservation biology, or, you know, one of the fields that fits right in that umbrella? And then from there, where did you end up?
So I was a geographic science major, so geography. And mm-hmm. then my minor was actually in theater, because I actually was quite shy. So I wanted to learn how to better do public speaking and to do improv, because it scared me, right? So being able to have that as kind of another thing for me to learn has been really helpful in my career. So I was doing all the STEM coursework and then doing improv classes. So that combination was really cool. So I did my undergrad at a school in Virginia called James Madison University. And then I wasn't planning to go directly into grad school, but because I come from a relatively low income background, I couldn't afford a master's without a scholarship. And I got a full one through Rotary Foundation, through the International Rotary Foundation. I was actually able to make a case for the first time ever in my district about the direct link between environmental health and human health. I was, I think, one of the only non-political science people that they've ever had in my district, and definitely the first conservationist. So because of that, I actually got a full ride to grad school in South Africa. So I ended up going directly. I think I had 3 months off, and then I was on a plane to South Africa right after my undergrad graduation. So I did like a short stint with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife for an internship, a paid internship, and then immediately got on a plane. So that was kind of fun. So I did my master's degree at the University of Cape Town through the Fitzpatrick Institute, which is an interdisciplinary institute. They say it's ornithology, but it's a bunch of different people. And I did my master's degree researching some of the social cultural changes after apartheid in the north of South Africa, looking at how changes in cultural shifts and people returning back after apartheid ended changed herding practices, and that changed grazing practices, and that changed vegetation communities. So that was my master's.
Wow. Oh, that sounds fascinating. And I mean, yeah, it's so interesting. So I'm hoping to be going to El Salvador to do some research on carnivore movement and ecology through my PhD. And where these places where the socio-political, cultural aspects and, you know, really traumatic history of these countries influences the behavior of these animals and, you know, colonization and farming and all of these things. It's so complicated. And one of the reasons I'm so excited to get to talk to you is that you are someone who looks so directly at all of these different parts. Because I think that's something that as conservationists can often be a bit of a blind spot. Not always. A lot of, like, I feel like the more people I talk to, the more I'm finding people who are trying to look at everything. But I don't think it is a given, especially when you're like a baby conservationist. So
there's so much to learn, right? And I think that's kind of one of the reasons that it's so important to. One of the biggest things I learned in my career. So I did my undergraduate thesis on lion-livestock conflict in Kenya. And I remember I was 20. It was my first time doing any of this. And I remember just kind of being completely shocked, because this one guy who's a Kenyan conservationist, you know, he said, okay, but if you Americans know everything, where is your megafauna? And I'm like, okay, like decent point, right? Like that actually makes a lot of sense. And then it kind of made me understand, you know, like it's so crucial to approach problems with both confidence and humility. It's like, you know what you know, but also understand that when you're coming into a system that's not your own, they are the experts. The people that live there are the experts about the place and how things work. And it's really important to form these really strong partnerships where they can help guide some of your questions. Because if you come in with assumptions, mm-hmm. sometimes you're solving a problem that actually isn't the biggest problem and isn't the most helpful problem, right. or isn't being done in a sustainable way or a way that can be accessed by people. So the question mm-hmm. becomes, are you doing your research for you to just get a degree, or do you want it to actually do some good when you're gone? So that's something that I try to let it guide my work for sure.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think that's probably the most important message that we're going to get out of this little series of episodes we're doing on, you know, how to responsibly conduct, you know, not just international field work, but also just anytime you're going into another community. I was just at a bonfire with my lab last night talking about, and there was a conversation going around about people who had done field work in the Deep South and the Southeast, you know, and we're in Corvallis, Oregon, and people talking about, you know, some of the cultural issues and safety issues for some of them, if you're non-binary or, you know, a person of color, but also figuring out how to, as some, you know, an academic from Oregon come into, you know, an area outside of Chattanooga and be effective and, you know, not just focus on the salamanders, but also, you know, the situation around the salamanders. Yeah,
exactly. And I think a lot of people get into wildlife because we like wildlife, not necessarily that we necessarily want to hang out with a bunch of different people, right? So it's something that a lot of us have to kind of learn. And I think the most important thing that anyone can do, especially if you're an early career conservationist, is to understand your own positionality. It's like, where you come from, what are you about, and how can that maybe affect how you see things? And also to understand that conservationists, we're not neutral parties in any kind of, especially in conflict work. We have our own agendas, we have our own biases. Mm-hmm. So understanding for yourself what those are can help kind of guide that in terms of trying to, you know, figure out a way to overcome those biases, to try to meet people where they are, and to create, you know, mutually beneficial solutions.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So for you, you know, you said that growing up with cancer, you know, and going through all of that physical therapy really helped you understand where people are coming from and learn to relate to people. How did being a person of color affect, you know, your career trajectory, whether that's in school or relating to people outside of school? Was it helpful in South Africa or not?
it's been interesting, I guess, is kind of the coded answer to that. So just to be clear, my dad's Black, my mom's white. I'm also a little Indigenous as well. So as kind of a mixed person, as a biracial person, multiracial mm-hmm. person, it's interesting because it's like, I've kind of grown up as someone who is also both a Brazilian and a US national, seeing things kind of from the outside, you know, so like I don't feel mm-hmm. fully American or fully Brazilian, and growing into conservation as a person of color in some ways, I think, again, it's kind of like having kind of like many different identities as part of my identity, having that intersectionality is very powerful mm-hmm. and helps me relate to and have empathy for a lot of different people. But at the same time, sometimes conservation can be difficult because you may be the only person in the room who is a person of color. And that can be challenging. I think a big challenging thing with my career is trying to kind of remind people that I'm not a DEI specialist. I may be passionate about it, care about it in my work. I may have a personal stake in things being anti-racist, apart from just, I like my life to be easier as well. But also totally. I think there is a tendency to sometimes put more focus on DEI work for scientists of color, for example, than on their own research. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting a couple mm-hmm. years ago when I was realizing that I was getting more speaking gigs for DEI stuff than for conservation stuff. And I'm like, well, I'm not a DEI expert. I live in this world and I can only speak from my own perspective. Like, so that's a really, it's been an interesting thing. And I think conservation, because of how, especially conservation in the United States, because of how it's kind of like come out in terms of, you know, like it was very exclusionary for a very long time. And we're just mm-hmm. starting to try to open it up again, or not again, open it up. But then there's challenges like people even knowing that you can be a conservationist. So my dad is an immigrant. Mm-hmm. My dad did not necessarily want me to be a conservationist. It's doctor or engineer, right? So having to, and he's fine with it now. Sometimes he jokes I'm going to be the wrong doctor. Yeah. But yeah, he's
right.
But
yeah.
It's just kind of one of those things of like, one of the funniest things he ever said to me was on a plane where he's like, what if they ask for a doctor? Like, what can you do? You're going to identify that he's not a lion? And I'm like, yeah, like I can tell if this is going to have a heart attack, I can tell he's not a lion. So it's super useful. But yeah, so this whole thing of just like, there's a lot of pressures that come with being a minority in a space, right? And luckily, and that's not true for everybody. That's not everyone's experience. If you're in certain programs, it can be a lot easier. But my experience was that, you know, it's been sometimes I've had to find my communities. And I think things like Science Twitter and Black Mammologist Week and all those things, like I finally met people who are like me. And it's really cool. So there's kind of like this community that I've built for myself. So even if I'm in a place that, like, I go to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is a great university, but there aren't many people of color in my department, let alone black people.
Yeah, Wisconsin's pretty white. I grew up in northern Wisconsin. Pretty white state.
Yeah. So, but I have this much larger conservation community outside of my department. So I think like it's just kind of you find who your people are. You find people who can kind of connect to you, and you can kind of share resources. And yeah, so it's not been a bad thing. Like I don't regret. Yeah. Obviously, I had no say in the matter, but like I'm proud of who I am. I'm proud of where I come from. I'm proud of my entire background. I think just one of those things of like, as conservationists, we need to, there's a two-pronged thing, because you hear a lot about recruitment. You hear about how do we get more people of color into conservation, which has its own challenges considering that it's incredibly underpaid and doesn't tend to reward people for their hard work, and it's hard to break in, and people drop out all the time in their early career. I just was very lucky that I kind of was farther enough in my career that I never had that kind of like danger zone, because I was always either in school or in a job, but that's not the case for so many people. And I sometimes do think that, you know, if I hadn't gotten that scholarship at that crucial time to get my master's, I might've just dropped out of conservation and gone into a different profession. So recruitment is a problem, but at the same time, it's also retention. So if it is kind of a thing where it's like you are kind, in most spaces, maybe one of the only people in the room, how do you make those spaces safe for people that they want to stay? And how do you make sure that everyone who is not, you know, of a marginalized community understands kind of like how to treat that person without microaggressions and to be sensitive? And there's just so much work that needs to be done. But I think a lot of that work is needs to be also focused on retention, because there's people like, we're here, like we exist. So it's like, how can we take care of the people that we already have in conservation? And one thing that was really funny is that, you know, I was asked at a former employment opportunity, basically, do you want to do DEI? And I told the person, I'm like, the best thing that I can do for representation and recruitment and retention is for me to do a good job at my job. And I think that's a really important thing to remember, is that, you know, like supporting the people who already are there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that makes sense on a lot of levels. And, you know, it's always easier, you know, like this is maybe a gross comparison, but, you know, we talk about this in business where it's always easier to maintain a customer than it is to get a new one. And it's easier to have people stay in the field and try to maintain them in the field than it is to constantly be trying to recruit people. And, you know, as you said, I mean, there's so many barriers in conservation, and pay is a huge one. And, you know, again, actually at the same bonfire I was at last night, you know, there's a couple undergrads who were just finishing up their field season, working for one of my lab mates. And, you know, they heard that I was the conservation dog person, and they all come over and they're all wide eyed and they're like, how do I get into the conservation dog field? And I was like, okay, like, here are the things that I can tell you. You know, first off, subscribe to this podcast because it's free. And we've got 175 episodes. You'll find something useful. But also, you know, so like, here are all the things you can do, but also, you know, let's sit down and like, okay, get yourself another beer. We're going to sit down and talk about, you know, some of the pros and cons of this field and like, what do you actually want for yourself, and your life, as far as, you know, home ownership and stable income and being in the same community forever. Do you want to have a job where you're home for dinner with your kids consistently? You know, because maybe that's something that can happen within the conservation dog world, but I don't know many people who do it. The vast majority of people in the conservation dog world, we don't have kids.
Yeah, they're expensive.
I know, like, but they're very expensive. And it's hard, you know, like, when I'm spending 7 weeks in Kenya and then I'm home for a couple weeks and then I'm off to Guatemala for 2 weeks and I'm home for a couple months and then I'm, you know, and even we're applying for a project to send my teammates out on in Wyoming. You know, it doesn't have to be exotic around the world, but if you're working in Wyoming when your partner lives in Montana, you're not home for dinner. You know, it doesn't matter. These states are very large.
I literally broke up with a potential boyfriend because I was like, I'm moving to Namibia. And he was just like, is that a line? And I'm like, no, bro. Like, it's not. No, you know? No. It's like, I literally have to go. Like, this is my job. And I do think that, like, once you pass far enough in your career that you have some stability, it's better, but you have to kind of get there. And that can take a decade. It's like, do you want to have a decade of potential unrest? Can you handle that? Can your family handle that? And I think it's really good to be frank with people about conservation is a wonderful field. You can wake up every day and know that you're making a difference, really live your value system and make an impact. But at the same time, it also demands of you in a way that many fields do not. And you just kind of have to, I speak to a lot of undergrads and I always have to kind of dance this careful line, right? Like, be really careful about, I don't want to be discouraging and have people who would be amazing for this field just get scared and like not do it. But I also don't want to tell people it's sunshine and rainbows and it's like perfect all the time. So what I usually tell people is I'm like, if you are really into conservation and you dig into it and this is what you want to do for life, literally nothing will stop you. Nothing should stop you. The barriers and the walls are for other people. Okay. Just keep going. Right. If you get into this and you're like, oh, this is interesting, but I can see myself do other things, do the other things and do conservation as a side thing. Cause like, you don't necessarily have to go full on into field work. And also there's many different ways to be a conservationist. So people will be like, oh, but I'm not good at math or I don't want to hike. And I'm just like, you can be a fundraiser. You can be an attorney. You can be a graphic designer. You could be a writer. Mm-hmm. You could be an economist. You could be literally anything, or an engineer, and also apply that into conservation.
And we need more of that, honestly. There's plenty of people who want to band birds. And that's an amazing job to have for a couple summers. I've actually never had a bird banding gig, but it just feels like the example. We need more people doing that sort of stuff. And like, I know I got my first conservation dog job after I'd worked in conservation advocacy, and politics was not my bag, it turns out. After that, you know, I learned how to build websites, and I was building websites actually for dog trainers and using that as a way to also kind of push forward to some dog welfare things. And then eventually got a job working on the websites and social media and, you know, fundraising emails and those sorts of things for an organization. And then I was able to like take that sidestep into working with the dogs and being in the field. But, you know, realistically, if I really wanted to have a family and a stable career, it actually would have made perfect sense for me to stay more in that like outreach and communications lane and still do all of the amazing impact that I really cared about. And I was still getting to like go to a bunch of the field sites and meet all of the people and do a lot of stuff, because if you're on the communications team, you have to do some of the on the ground stuff. So anyway, you know, it's just, you don't have to do whatever the hardest version of this is.
And also everyone's journey is their own. So it's always really interesting because people kind of come up to you. I'm TAing this semester, a bunch of freshmen coming up to me being like, how do I be a conservationist? And I'm like, everyone comes into it differently. Like, you're going to come into it differently depending on what your skill sets are and what your opportunities are. And some of that you can have some control over. You can build up certain skill sets, but also you just have to kind of like not have such a rigid idea of what the path to being what you're going to do is. My first job was that U.S. Fish and Wildlife gig. I was on a tern colony. I didn't ban anything. I was doing nest productivity checks while I was being dive bombed by like angry roseate terns. So that was super fun. But like I work with carnivores and I've always wanted to work with carnivores. And if I had turned up my nose at that job, I wouldn't have gotten important skill sets. So I think it's really important when you're really early to not, again, like avoid being rigid, being like anything I do is going to teach me things, is going to teach me what I don't like, which is also really important, and guide me in a direction. And honestly, because conservation is so competitive, learning other skill sets that aren't strictly field skill sets is crucial. Like if you are good at stats or good at, again, like building websites or graphic design, or you can write a mean grant application, like all of these things will help you. And I think that in some ways, our education system kind of doesn't really prepare people to be employed once they leave as a conservationist, because we're just teaching these very traditional skill sets.
Yeah. I think I've told this story on the podcast before, but I was offered an REU that ended up, I wasn't able to take, but basically I was offered the REU because I was fluent in Spanish. I could drive stick and I had been, I'd been teaching rock climbing because they had had a student in the past who, or an REU student in the past who, couldn't drive their field vehicles, couldn't communicate with all of their field staff. This was in Panama, and was too scared to deal with, you know, climbing and rappelling in and out of these caves to get, it was a vampire bat project in Panama. And I'm still sad I didn't get to do it. But yeah, like the three skills that stood out to them on my CV were absolutely not the years of, you know, mist netting and electroshocking and like my, you know, honors mammalogy class. Like none of that was actually, because there's a dime a dozen.
You really have to be able to
stand out.
You just really have to be able to stand out. And that's by also kind of leaning into your personal interests and your personal, like, like you said, like rock climbing, like, you know, you never know when like a hobby or a side interest will help you in your career. And I think the worst thing that people can do is be too laser focused.
No, I love that you minored in theater. That's brilliant. Was that strategic when you were 18? Were you like an unusually prescient 18-year-old?
Yeah, I did it on purpose. Like I didn't want to be an actor or anything, but like I really, like I said, I was scared of public speaking. I knew I had to talk to a lot of people to be in conservation. I wanted to be able to communicate my thoughts better, and I wanted to get over kind of like my nerves. And honestly, like it's funny because it's like I maybe draw back on that minor more than I do my STEM stuff, because it's like that's what I do. It's like what I do is I talk to people, and sometimes people who are quite angry at me. And it has nothing to do with me. It's, it's what I represent. You know, if I pitch up and I'm wearing like a cheetah on my chest and I'm pitching up to people who lost a bunch of livestock, they come in with assumptions too. And so a lot of my job is actually de-escalation or trying to find that commonality. Like, what can we agree on? Okay, we agree on livestock is important. We agree on how do we try to reduce losses. What we don't agree on is, if somebody says, oh, I'm going to go shoot this cheetah, it's actually not my space to say no. And I think that's kind of a misconception of people in terms of how conservationists work with HWC, is that the worst thing you could say is basically try to tell people what to do with wildlife on their own land. So you have to try to, so one thing that I used to do is like, and it's again, drawing on my improv classes. There was this one farmer who was like a total jackal killer. Like he loved killing jackals. I had gone up to this farmer who was really keen on killing jackals and told him, no, killing jackals are morally wrong and they're good for the environment. What does this guy care? He's losing a bunch of sheep. Like he hates jackals. And honestly, it's kind of justified, right? So what I, what I told him is true. If you shoot out jackals, jackals will breed faster. Jackals will make more jackals. You will have more jackals on your land. And he just looks at me and he goes, I don't want that, you know? And that was really the thing that got to him. The other thing is that he really wanted to shoot out this leopard that had been going after his calves. Again, if I had wagged my finger at him and said, you know, like, leopards are important for the environment. What are you doing? Like, that would just make a more of an us versus them problem. So what I told him, which again is based in biological fact, is that, okay, we might not like this leopard, but he is your leopard. If you shoot this leopard, you're going to get three leopards fighting for territory and you're going to lose a lot more livestock. So he actually ended up naming the leopard. It became his leopard. We would give him data that would basically say, like, guess what this leopard is doing this week? And he became invested in it because it became his leopard. So it's trying to not lecture the people or to come at it from your own position. Because, of course, my objective is to make him not shoot the leopard. But you can't really, you have to have empathy for the fact that people are dealing with real problems. And that has to be as equal in importance to the conservation concern. And I think that's the hard part. I don't think that's always kept as equal in people's minds when they're working at it from a conservation perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love the way that you were able to bring in, all of these biological facts and these things that you know in order to explain how actually dealing with this, like removing this one animal might not have the result that you're hoping for, because you're creating basically a power vacuum, and we all know what that looks like. Yeah, that's really neat. So you were just in Botswana doing some prep work, and I think that there's some things to learn about how that meeting actually went. So you were not going to Botswana to just go around and track down these animals. You know, you didn't have your telemetry equipment with you, I assume. You had some other stuff with you. So tell us about what you were doing there and how that relates to, you know, avoiding continuing the pattern of kind of parachute conservation and colonialism as it relates to conservation.
Yeah, for sure. So as someone who has some African ancestry but is not from Africa, I have to be very mindful of that, right? My positionality is I'm coming from the West, right? And in order to be ethical and sustainable, one thing that I always do no matter where I work is I do not do anything unless I have I have an on-the-ground affiliate who's been there for a decade or more. Ideally, it is staffed full of people in positions of power from that country. Ideally, it's run by a person from that country, but who is a strong affiliate who is based in communities that they've worked with for at least a decade. And the reason for that is multifaceted. Trying to get any work done in any kind of community-based conservation if they don't know you is basically almost impossible. They are rightfully not going to care about the work that you're doing because they literally don't know you. And it takes a long time to create those relationships, and you have to be quite patient. And even if you have the on-the-ground affiliates, you have to be quite patient. There's a lot of meeting people. You're sitting down, you know, like at their homesteads, and you're just talking to them and you're getting to know them as human beings. You can't speed through that process. A lot of researchers try to turbo through that process so they can just put some camera traps up, but like you can't. You really have to create those relationships. Mm-hmm. And also kind of, again, the humility factor, right? Of like you go into a community with your on-ground affiliate, you get introduced, you meet people, but also they might tell you that the problem that you think is the problem is not the problem. Or they might say, oh, but it's over here. Or there might be concerns. And I think like a big thing that I was thinking about is I'm doing a before after control impact design. So just describing what that is, that basically means that I have an experimental livestock enclosure and a control livestock enclosure. So the experimental livestock enclosure has like a deterrent, like say a flashing light system, and the control does not. One thing that when I was thinking about this is the control farmers are losing livestock. How do you equitably choose who would be a control farmer? That could be very unethical, which is why there aren't a lot of like before after control impact designs. So what the solution that the NGO and I came up with is that at the end of the project, we actually will donate the deterrent that we determined worked the best to those control farmers. So they have something that will then help them with their losses at the end of the study period, which isn't very long. It's about 6 months. But also idea that we can keep them updated. We'll tell them about what's happening with their neighbors. They have something to look forward to and something that they can be invested in. They can ask questions about these methodologies, and it can be equitable and ethical. And that was something that before I even put anything up, that was something that I'm thinking about is how do I avoid causing unintentional harm by trying to help? Which is why it's so important to have these affiliates. Because I said, like, what's a good way to do this? What's a good way to not make things tense in the community or
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because if, you know, farmer A has a bunch of livestock that he loses overnight and they're in, you know, the control group. Yeah. It seems like, especially in small communities or areas where tensions are high, and I don't know much about Botswana kind of socioeconomically or climactically right now, but when we were in Kenya, you know, they were at the tail end of a drought that my understanding is has finally more or less broken. But you know, tensions and desperation was just running so high that you wouldn't want to do anything that could cause, you know, strife within the community as well. And also, you know, again, as we were talking about with these livestock losses, like this is a very, very real, huge socioeconomic factor for these people. They're not just, you know, it's not like, oh, they're backyard chickens and they lost one to a fox, which, you know, is still a bummer. I've been through it, but you know, my family wasn't going to not eat when our chickens got munched.
There's also cultural factors of livestock being important for social standing. So it's not even just things like economic. And I think it's a mistake to kind of think of things just in terms of economic things. You know, there's also, also the intangible costs, the fear of when is it going to happen? I don't know when it's going to happen. How bad is it going to be? And the stress kind of around the idea that it could happen at any time, you know, it's like, so there, and there's a whole lack of control thing, and people react more strongly to things that are outside of their control. That's just human nature. So yeah, so I think a lot of this is very complex, and having that on-ground affiliate not only allows you to be ethical, it also allows you to be sustainable. So what I'm doing is my project has been co-designed with these people. So I have my committee, but I also am co-designing it with this NGO, and it's fitting within the mosaic of things that they're already doing. And it will also be presented at these working forums of all of the big carnivore NGOs in Botswana, where we can say, okay, this worked well here, this worked well here, this worked well here. And then that becomes part of that conversation that can be moved forward on ground long after my PhD. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you get connected with this NGO and with these groups? Because it seems like that's, you know, these on the ground affiliates is so important. But how do you find them?
Sure. Yeah. Well, the cool thing is that once you're in carnivore conservation, you literally can throw a rock and you'll hit like seven of the people who work on your same species. We all know each other, at least of each other. Yeah. But in terms of getting connected, when I was first starting out, I would dry email people. So when I created the environmental video game, I created Operation Ferdinand, where that was just literally just my friend and me, who's a software engineer, working together on this one project. I dry emailed people that I knew of, but we had never met. So I do think that you can broach that. I created this connection with these guys because CCF, Cheetah Conservation Fund, advise Cheetah Conservation Botswana in its early days, and they had that connection. Mm-hmm. But I actually didn't even use that connection to really meet them. I knew of them through that. So, but I was making a Fulbright application, which I received, but then COVID blew up, which is unfortunate. But I was applying for Fulbright, and then I dry emailed Rebecca Klein, who is the CEO of Cheetah Conservation Botswana, and just said, okay, here's what I bring to the table. This is what I'm thinking. How can this be useful for you? Let's design it together. And I did it far enough in advance that like we literally designed the project together. And I think that that's key. Kind of a two-parter thing of like not telling people what you're going to do, doing it with them, but also being very clear about what benefits are you bringing to them? Why should they want to work with you? Because it costs them time and it costs them energy and sometimes even funding, right? So I now have had relationships with CCB for 3 years. With a very strong, wonderful working relationship. And but that foundation has been crucial for my PhD.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, I mean, sounds similar to the project that I'm hoping to get off the ground in El Salvador. I read one paper that totally captured my imagination. Well, first I fell in love with the country and a boy there. And then I literally like went into Google Scholar and typed El Salvador conservation, I think. found a paper that said that contrary to popular belief, pumas are not extinct in El Salvador. And it was the first photographic evidence that they're not extinct. And that had just come out in 2020. So I emailed the lead author and was like, hey, this is amazing. What have you guys been doing since? Like, what's going on? I'm in the country. I've got scat dogs. Like, how could we work together? What does this look like? You know, and we're still working on what that's going to look like, but being able to, you know, really just come at it from this like place of curiosity and excitement. You know, they were excited to get to work with us and, pretty excited that we've got dogs to bring to the table, which is a nice thing that kind of comes with our line of work. And then, you know, for me as well, his English, Francisco's English is pretty good. But my Spanish is a lot better. And that's something we've talked about on past episodes about international work in particular is, you know, whether you just get to the place where you can do some niceties or if you can work in places that you're really able to converse in the native language. That's really helpful.
I'm nice at Swana right now and it is a challenge. But it's so important for relationships, even if you're not fluent, to show that you're putting in effort, to show that you care enough to be able to use the right honorifics, which is really important, especially in community work, making sure that, you know, you're being respectful and that you're respecting kind of like how people would prefer to be addressed and what's the appropriate way to address people, especially in cultures where there's a huge age component. Right. Being respectful. Yeah. And it's interesting Cattle Post because most of the people at Cattle Post are actually elderly or older. So for me, it's like not only coming as an outsider, but like as a younger person, like how do I express respect for these people? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Well, and that was something we ran into. It's funny. So in El Salvador, if you enter a restaurant or anywhere where people are eating, you say provecho to like every person. So like bon appetit or something to every person. And Danielle and I were traveling to Guatemala, and he noticed immediately that people didn't do that just across the border, you know, and these are countries the size of states. And he was like, oh my God, these Guatemalans, like, they're so rude. And he was, you know, had his panties all in a bunch over it. And then we realized, you know, a couple days later that what you do in Guatemala is as you stand up to leave, you announce provecho to the entire restaurant and to the chef. And yeah, it just happens after. It was one of those little things where it's like, gosh, even as you're traveling through these like teeny tiny countries and even being fluent in the language, there's still just these like little things where it would be so easy for someone to think that I'm being rude because I send my compliments to the chef and wish everyone a good meal at the wrong time. And I have not yet found any good books that actually get into that level of nuance or like consistent guides that get into that level of nuance. I do think that's the sort of thing that like, just do your best to be polite and do the best you can. And hopefully someone will like correct you.
For sure.
Or guide you at some point and at least understand your intention.
Yeah, and also understand that like different countries. So the good thing about me being Brazilian is actually I draw a lot on Brazil because Brazil is very similar to many African countries where it's relationships first. Mm-hmm. So it's all about where, like, who do you know and creating those relationships, and that relationships are really important. You know, we always joke about Brazil time, you know, outside of Sao Paulo. It's like, but it's really funny in Brazil. So like, there's this thing that people do, and it's a thing that I've seen in other places too, which is amazing, where you kind of do this little parade of visiting people. And everyone has a perfect idea of how long this visit is supposed to last. It's always exactly around an hour, and they can like just sense it. Like nobody looks at the watch, like they just know. And you go to important people in the community, which are also often elderly people, and you sit down and you have a chat with them, and they chat with you, and you just talk to them. And it's kind of creating those important bonds. And if you try to get out of that early or you try to skip somebody, like people will be straight up offended. When I was a little kid, I was always like, mom, like, dad, I don't want to like go talk to like, don't know whoever, like we just talked to like seven of them. He's like, no, like, she will know that we didn't sit with her and she will be upset. And, so it's keeping those relationships alive is really important. And it's less of a time conscious thing. Like I think as Americans, we're always about like, need to be efficient, need to be on time, but you're investing in those relationships. And it's really important to take that time and again, get to know people as human beings. And to let them know that like you're not just doing this for your PhD, you're doing this out of genuine concern for the situation and trying to help. And that's really important. But it's really funny how like I find myself kind of drawing from this more collectivist culture as a Brazilian in my field work, where I'm just like, it's like going to visit the donas, you know, like we're gonna go just sit down and we'll have a chat. And I think that's really helped me connect with people.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and that's something where I can see, again, these on-the-ground affiliates and really having the humility and the patience to let them take the lead and not having your own agenda is so, so important. Because again, like, I don't know if I had picked up a book on Central American manners, if it would have explained to me that in El Salvador, provecho comes first and in Guatemala, it comes at the end. But just, you know, being able to watch people and being really, really curious about that and, you know, trying not to be the one who's ending every conversation. Like, that's such a good point as, you know, Americans, you know, if I find myself always being the one who's wrapping up conversations, that's probably a sign that I'm doing some amount of cultural faux pas.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah. I think, if I had to give advice to anyone who wants to be a conservationist, they're like, what do I need to know? What should I do? I'd say the best tool in your toolbox is empathy. Before anything else, it's having the ability to set aside your preconceptions and really connect with other humans, because you will be working with people. I don't care if you're like, whatever you're working on, there will be people, you'll be working with them. And being able to generally care about what their opinions are, even if they might be quite different from yours. Because that's another thing that, like, I've had to learn, which is very hard, is that the guy who wants to shoot the leopard is not objectively wrong. It is a point of view. Just like my point of view of not wanting him to shoot the leopard is objectively wrong. And it's hard, because it's like, I've been in situations where a farmer would call me and they'd be like, if you don't get here in 10 minutes, I'm going to shoot this cat. And then I show up and they have a cheetah skin for me, right? And you feel upset, right? Like, you can't help it. But you have to kind of put that aside and be like, okay, this is the situation. This is how I feel about that. How can I improve this going forward? And at the same time, even at your most upset, trying to understand it. And I think that is really important, because in the kind of conflict world, human wildlife conflict is a very loaded term. I use it because it's just what's used, but it's not my favorite term, because really every human wildlife conflict is human human conflict, or it's human wildlife is conflict about wildlife or conflict with other people. And the thing that I think is really hard for conservationists to learn is that a lot of the time the conflict is with us as conservationists. Mm-hmm. So we have to just kind of admit that there is kind of like this loadedness to being a conservationist and maybe past things that have happened, and you're not coming in at blank slate. You're coming into a situation where they may have had bad interactions with conservationists in the past. So it's trying to not make tensions worse, and also hopefully through your relationship with them, improve their idea of what conservationists can be. So it's a lot of responsibility. And none of this is about science, you know, like, we're scientists, but 90% of the work is completely unrelated to that. And I think that's a hard thing to explain to people who are looking to be a scientist.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a great point to wrap up on. And, you know, I know we didn't really touch on dogs as well, but I think we've done this in the past. But, you know, it's also, it's a whole other level when you're the person showing up in another culture and, you know, people may or may not be afraid of your working dog. They may or may not understand why they're there. They may be worried about that dog interacting with their livestock. You know, there's a lot of stuff that just the dogs just add a whole other extra level. But then in a lot of cases, they can also be a total superpower, because in cultures where dogs are viewed, you know, similarly to how they're viewed in North America, which is not all cultures, but in places where that is, you know, they really break down barriers and people get excited. And, you know, people, you've got this, you've got your own kind of charismatic megafauna right at your side that can really help people get excited. That was definitely when I was doing aquatic invasive species work in Yellowstone. You know, people are not stoked to have you stop their boat and inspect their boat really carefully. But when you explain that the dogs are a lot faster, so this is much better for you, I promise you're going to get out and go fishing very soon. And B, you know, like, they're just happy. Like, a lot of times the kids are the ones that are the fussiest, and the kids are going to be excited to see the dog. And you can use the dogs for the outreach as well. But being cognizant, again, that that's not always going to be the case. Niffler, my younger dog, when we were in El Salvador, I can't tell you how many times I, you know, people, you know, they pull their kids away and they put themselves in between the dog and the kid. And, you know, people will say, oh my God, that's a wolf. You know, and he's a border collie. He's got pointy ears and he's gray. So, you know, to me, I'm like, what are you talking about? But anyway, I don't need to go down a huge rabbit hole with that line of thinking.
Can I do a plug for CCB? So Chia Conservation about Skoda does work with dogs. They do livestock guardian dog program. Their program is one of the most culturally sensitive and interesting programs I've ever seen, because they're not like taking the big Anatolians from Turkey. They're actually training local dogs. They're called Swana dogs. They're basically like street dogs, or like the random dogs that get bred. Some of them like look like little dachshunds. Some of them are huge. Like they're just all over the place. But they work, and they tested them, and they are 80% effective at reducing losses in the field, which is about the same as an Anatolian, and they live a lot longer because they're adapted to the environment. They're healthier. They can live on scraps. Like, you don't have to feed them anything special. And they already are dogs that everyone's familiar with because they're just around. So they have this amazing thing where they'll just buy these random dogs from like just local farmers that, like, you know, their dog, they have dogs.
A litter.
And then they'll just put the dogs in with the goats, and the dogs will learn that the goat is their the goats are their family. And sometimes they're often with an older dog that will teach them. And I always joke that it's goat o'clock, because we'll be working in the office, and then the livestock guardian dogs, like, completely autonomously will just come through, and they'll come through and they'll lead their herds through. And you'll be like, oh yeah, there's like Gift and like there's whatever. And then like there's one that, like, I swear looks like a dachshund had like with a German shepherd. He's the weirdest looking dog, but he's just like trotting on his little legs, and it's just...
Do you have photos of him? We can share. Okay, thank you.
And like these tiny little legs, and he's just kind of trying. I'm like, oh baby boy, I don't know what's up with you. But he, they're doing their job. And, but the fact that it is these local dogs, is brilliant.
That's amazing. Isn't that cool?
Yeah. So definitely check out Cheetah Conservation Botswana's Livestock Gardening Program, because after years of being around LGD programs, I've been, I hung out with one of the flagships. They're all really cool.
Yeah.
But this is a specifically really cool take, because it's taking those local animals and putting them to use.
I was not aware of that program, and that there are people using these local dogs. And we get people ask that occasionally on the detection dog side of things. And I think where we've kind of come down on it so far has been, we just haven't had a long-term enough project on the ground where it makes sense to be looking for and screening the local dogs. Although it's totally possible. Like Christine Figner, who we've had on the show before, we haven't had on the show. She's in our class. She works with sea turtles in Costa Rica, and her sea turtle nest detection dog is a local dog.
Very cool.
But yeah, you do kind of have to be on the ground for long enough that you can look for the right dog for this line of work, and then train the dog, and then do the field work. And for us and the model that we're in, that doesn't work for us right now. But you know, even when, you know, you and I have that shared connection with Action for Cheetahs in Kenya, you know, their dog Maddie is just, he's a local. Yeah. We love Maddie. He's just he's a local mixed dog. He's a very good boy.
A collie mixed with a Roddy or something. I have no idea what he is, but yeah, he's cute.
that's what they've said. Yeah. But you know, and when we were talking about coming there, and you know, they were talking about, oh, we might need another dog, and we were like, okay, do you want us to try to screen a dog and train a dog and then bring it over with us? You know, and they partially, it wasn't the right time, but partially they were also like, you know, honestly, a lot of the diseases here, we just have better, like, literal survivability with dogs that are born and raised here, like trypanosomiasis and those sorts of things. Like, the dogs that come from North America and Western Europe just don't have the same, they're not made of the same stuff anymore.
In the extreme environments of the Kalahari, it's like you need dogs that will be able to be adapted to them. They're okay with, like, surviving in that really harsh environment. For sure. So cool.
Definitely. Well, all right. Is there anything else that you wanted to say? I know we said we were wrapping up on the empathy point, and then we just went down another rabbit hole. So sorry,
cut that in later. It's cool. I think what I would just, for people who are, who's your target audience? I actually should ask that. Are there people who are conservationists, or who are interested in conservation, or?
We've got a pretty solid mix in our listeners between dog people who want to work in conservation and conservation people who want to work with dogs. But most of them are early career, probably 25 to 35 women would be like our average person.
So they're already on the conservation train. I don't have to tell people that their conservation is important. The best advice that I could give is that, again, if you want to be in conservation, literally, and this is what I had to tell myself every single day for like 5 years straight, especially in that very early period right after undergrad, the obstacles are for other people. They're to stop other people. So don't let anything discourage you from going down that path. But also to make sure that you take care of yourself as a person. I think it's really easy as a conservationist to forget to be a whole person, to, again, like literally touch grass for fun, not for work, like just touch grass. Make sure that you also, while you want to be focused, while you want to be relentless, while you don't want to give up, protect your mental health and keep your relationships. And it's easier said than done. But some of the best things that I've learned is that you can't give so much of yourself to your work that you forget how to be a human. Make sure that you keep that balance, and then you'll be an even better conservationist.
Yeah, it's like, absolutely.
Who considers a conservationist, right?
Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing. Especially as, you both of us are very overwhelmed and stressed out right now. It's like, I've got my little candle going and I'm going to go on a run later and I took a stress nap and, we gotta do the things.
If you want to find me, I am on Twitter at Fleury, F-L-E-U-R-Y, G as in golf, S as in Sam, on Twitter. I am less active than that right now. I've actually moved mostly to Instagram. My Instagram handle is called BeSciCurious, and I will be posting more content as I continue to work on this project. So please do reach out. And I'm sure that there will be a link for my website somewhere. If people have any wishes to reach out, just definitely contact me there.
Yeah. And where can people get your video game?
My video game. I will send a link through. It's a little rusty right now because there's been a lot of operating changes, operating system changes since we made it. But I can send you a link for PCs.
We'd love that. Yeah. All right. So, and as always, people can find those in the show notes. So don't worry about trying to write anything down if you are driving on the freeway. As always, thank you so much for listening. I hope you learned a lot and you're feeling inspired to get outside and be a canine conservationist in whatever way suits your passions and skill set. You can find the show notes, donate to Canine Conservationists, join our Patreon, or sign up for our Conservation Detection Dog Handler course, all at canineconservationists.org. Until next time.